So today I'm going to expand the instruction to include thoughts or thinking. And I'm glad that most of you could wait, not think until today, and waited dutifully for the instructions. But now you don't have to wait, now you can. There's a feeling sometimes among people who are interested in meditation that the point of meditation is to have a silent mind and not to have any thoughts at all. And that is a little bit of a misunderstanding. It's possible occasionally to have a mind that seems to have no thoughts at all. And those are fairly rare. And some of these forms of states are maybe not even so valuable to have. Mostly when we're meditating, there are thoughts there. We're thinking, some level of thinking, and you don't need to be at war with your thoughts, which some meditators are. They think thoughts get in the way. It's fine, it's okay to have thoughts there. More important than a silent mind is to have a silent heart, to allow the heart to be silent, in whatever way that means for you when you hear those words. But thoughts often are a difficult place for meditators or people who do mindfulness practice to focus on. Thoughts tend to be the thing that pulls us away from the present moment the most. Thoughts about the future, thoughts about the past, daydreaming, fantasy. So finding a way to work with thoughts is very important. So I want to talk a little bit about thoughts and thinking. There's a beautiful story from the Zen tradition of these two Zen monks who were crossing a river. They were on a pilgrimage. And when they came to the river to cross it, there was she was probably a beautiful 16-year-old virgin or something, whatever kind of fantasy monks have. Anyway, there was a beautiful young woman there. And one of the monks, she needed to get across the river, but she was in trouble getting across. So one of the monks picked her up and carried her across and put her down the other side. And the two monks continued on their pilgrimage. And the end of the day, just before they came to the destination, the monk who hadn't helped the woman said, how could you have done that? You're a monk, a Buddhist monk, and Buddhist monks, you aren't supposed to touch women. And how could you have touched this woman? Not only touched her, but you held her. How could you? And the first monk said in reply, I put her down back by the river. Why are you still carrying her? The power of thoughts. And then there's this beautiful, also this is from a Buddhist scripture. Some children were playing beside a river. They made castles of sand, and each child defended his castle and said, this one is mine. They kept their castle separate and would not allow any mistakes about which was whose. When the castles were all finished, one child kicked over someone else's castle and completely destroyed it. The owner of the castle flew into a rage, pulled the other child's hair, struck him in his fist, and bawled out, he has spoiled my castle. Come along, all of you, and help me to punish him as he deserves. The others all came to his help. They beat the child with a stick and then stamped on him as he lay on the ground. Then they went on playing in their sandcastles, each saying, this is mine. No one else may have it. Keep away. Don't touch my castle. But evening came. It was getting dark, and they all thought they ought to be going home. No one now cared about what became of his castle. One child stamped on his, another pushed his over with both hands. Then they turned away and went back, each to his home. A great story. We get so attached to certain things, and we defend it, and we get angry and criticize people. And to what purpose? At the end of the day, the ocean will come up and wash the sandcastles away. So many of our attachments are sandcastles of the mind. And they're even more ephemeral than sandcastles. But so many of us hold on to our thoughts and our beliefs so tightly that there's very little room for accepting, certainly their impermanence, But even understanding their nature, understanding that thoughts aren't necessarily things to be attached to or to hold on to or identify with. And it's probably thoughts themselves that we tend to identify with most strongly. We say, you know, I identify with our body or with our hair or with our profession or with stuff. But that identification almost certainly happens through the medium of thoughts, through the kind of way we think about things in our thinking. So, and thoughts is very much where we tend to get into trouble, the kind of thoughts we have, the fantasies we have, the ideas we have, spending too much time in the past, spending too much time in the future, not really being able to appreciate and enjoy the present moment. And normally we identify so closely with what we're thinking, we don't even realize that we're thinking. And many of us spend, you know, I think most of us spend all our waking hours thinking incessantly. And how many of the moments of wakefulness during your waking time are you aware that you're kind of lost in this endless train of thoughts? Maybe it's a good thing that we don't know so much because we get bored pretty quickly. I find it amazing that I can talk to myself all day long and not get bored. If anybody else did this, you know, it would be too much. And I'm sure if I spent all day speaking my thoughts out loud to any one of you, you could not keep it interested. But I stay interested. And why is that? There's nothing particularly noble with many of my thoughts, and some of them are so repetitive, the concerns, thinking about the same thing. I think it's because we identify with the thoughts. There's something very important going on there that we're relating to, and it's that we identify with, that which we relate to. And it speaks to our sense of self, the image we have of ourselves, the idea we have of ourselves. It speaks to our security, to our status, to our position, or threatens it in some way. And so all these thoughts kind of grab our interest because of the identification. If we didn't identify with our thoughts, they probably wouldn't keep our attention as much as they do. And if they didn't keep our attention as much as they do, there would probably be more moments in which we could wake up to the present moment in a more full and conscious way. Because our thoughts, being lost in our thoughts, often works as kind of a veil which covers our eyes or our senses, so that we're not so fully present. And I think it's no surprise and no that in many spiritual traditions they talk about, they say that many people, most people, go around asleep, and that what we're trying to do is to wake up. And I think being lost so much in our thoughts is a kind of being asleep or being turned off. So we have to find some way to break the cycles of thinking, or at least the cycles of a strong identification with our thoughts. And many people know this intuitively or instinctively, the necessity for this. And it's part of why a lot of people go do things like running or skiing or biking or motorcycle racing or skydiving or whatever they do. Because really doing so, taking a cold shower, or having sex or something, all these things are ways in which tend to interrupt the kind of pattern of identified thinking that kind of wind our minds into tighter and tighter, tighter springs of tension. And finding some way to kind of break that by distracting ourselves, by doing something radically different, is actually very, can be very, very healing. It's very useful. Just going for a walk. I saw a movie, a documentary some years ago about these people who would jump off skyscrapers. That was their hobby. And they would have these parachutes that they usually go find these skyscrapers that were being under construction, and they would sneak in and just before dawn and walk up to the very top with these backpacks with little kind of parachutes or I don't know what gliders, and then they'd unfold them or they I don't know how they did it but then and just as dawn was happening they'd jump off a skyscraper. And the parachutes would open, and they'd glide down to the street, and there'd be a getaway car there. And they'd jump in the getaway car and rush off, because I'm sure it was illegal. So they interviewed one of the people who did this, and he said, "It used to be that I did a lot of motorcycle racing. And this is the way that I'd unwind. And I needed some way to unwind in my life because I get all tense. But now I have a family with two children and a wife, and I have to make a lot of money, and there's no time anymore to go spend the weekend motorcycle racing and doing everything. So now I jump off skyscraper because it's very efficient. By the time I reach the bottom, my mind is completely clear. All my thoughts and worries and everything are completely, you know. So it's a very powerful way of getting into the present. So that's one way to do it. Some people just go for a jog. Another way to do it is to meditate. And meditation is a very effective way of cutting through the strong identification which causes us to wind up our mind in this tight balls of tension. But meditation is also a good habit to have, or a good practice to have, because in addition to helping us cut through some of that, it also helps us to witness and see more clearly what's going on, both in the surface of our mind and deep in our hearts and deep in our minds. So there's a possibility of wisdom and understanding arising. And as we develop wisdom and understanding of how our life works, then there's a possibility of not living in such a way that we get so tense or so wound up. So this one guy who jumped off skyscrapers to unwind, it was very effective. I'm sure it helped his life. But he didn't learn anything about himself. So he went back to his job and his busy life, and the dynamics that caused tension were still there. But hopefully through mindfulness practice, you begin understanding and seeing clearly how we respond to the world, how we relate to the world, and try to find another way of relating, one that's more peaceful and more balanced. So there's two primary ways of working with thoughts in meditation. And I think James, some of you came to the Monday night talk, talked about this, some of this stuff when he came about thoughts. But so I don't know how much of this will be overlap with his. But there are two general ways of working with thoughts. One is when we become mindful enough, quiet enough, to see and recognize what we're thinking, what the stories are, the concerns are, the fantasies are. When we start recognizing the content of our thoughts, then there's a possibility of redirecting our thinking in some new, different way. Redirecting according to what's called in Buddhism wise reflection. You recognize how you're thinking and you reflect about it and you discern, is this the wisest way to be thinking? Is this useful? Is it useful to be thinking about that Lexus which I better buy before June 28th? One more time. When you know you don't have the money to buy a Lexus. You know, so you're thinking, you know, over and over again, you're thinking about Lexus, and that Clinton, he's going to have Lexus, and embargoes, and, you know, is that useful? You know, so you recognize, oh, I keep thinking about Lexuses. And you say, well, that's not so useful to spend all my time thinking about that. And it's possible to just simply redirect your attention. Say, well, I'll think about the Volvos. Or I'll think about something that's more manageable, or I'll think about, you know, I mean, I'll think about what's a good thing to do for my spouse tonight. So you think about something productive, or you simply take a few moments to go outside or to breathe deeply and smell the flowers or do something nice. So we can learn to identify the unhealthy patterns of thinking, and it's possible sometimes simply to say, I'm not interested in thinking about Lexuses anymore. And think about something else. I do this kind of quite frequently. I kind of have to because I give so many talks, public talks, that at some point I say, I better start thinking about what I'm going to talk about next. I don't want to just show up kind of cold. And so I say, I don't have to think anymore about these strange thoughts, random thoughts I'm having. Or sometimes I'm thinking about thinking about something which is useful to think about, and say, well, I've done that now for a while, and now I'll think about something else. So it's possible to redirect your thoughts, and redirect your thoughts in wise and useful directions. Some teachers give their students the practice of counting their thoughts, or a particular kind of thoughts, like self-critical thoughts are good ones, or judgmental thoughts. Count how many times you judge someone in a day, especially if you have a habit of doing that, or criticizing yourself. And what happens is when you get to 392, it becomes funny. And you start seeing there's this endless pattern, and you have to smile. There's no other choice. You know, you get to 529. But if you don't count, you don't realize that you necessarily, that this is the 529th time you've had this particular theme of thought in one day. Because we identify, we don't see what's happening so clearly. And so we kind of are quite willing to continue. It's interesting to judge, right? But you count. Try it someday. Just start counting how many times you judge someone. And see if you don't start laughing after a while. However, having said all that, I think it's useful to say, or at least I want to say, that I mistrust the whole positive thought or affirmation movement that are found in some places in our culture. And the reason that I'm a little bit mistrustful of it, positive thinking or affirmation, as I understand it, and I could have it wrong, how it's taught by some people, is not just simply wisely redirecting your thinking in a certain direction, but it's something much more powerful. It's a kind of overlaying of a certain kind of thought pattern because you don't like something and you're trying to get away from some particular way you're thinking that might be self-destructive. Affirmations can function in a way you're taking this kind of thought, and using it as a cover, a louder cover for what's going on underneath. And if you're using it in that way, to simply cover what's going on, it becomes very dangerous. And what's going on underneath will come out in another way. And I've known people who've gone around affirmations saying, I am great, I am wonderful, I'm beautiful, I'm smart, whatever, or whatever it is. And it feels so forced, kind of like a forced smile on their face. And they're kind of holding something really dangerous for themselves away, you know, it's like, and they can't relax because they have to. If they relax, the deeper stuff comes up. So I'm a little bit mistrustful of positive thinking or affirmations. Though I'm sure it has its place. I'm sure it has useful places in many people's lives. What we're trying to do, what more useful from a Buddhist point of view, is rather than to superimpose some thought or idea over our life, is to spend time plummeting what your deepest intention is for your life. What is the thing you most want for yourself? What is your deepest intention? And that deepest intention then represents inevitably some deep beauty in anybody's life. And allow that deep intention to flower through the difficult parts of your life, rather than to cover the difficult parts of your life. So there's one whole way of working with thoughts is to redirect your thoughts, to have different thoughts. To some degree, that's useful and that's possible. Sometimes it's not possible. And I believe that re-educating the mind is never completely successful. For a kind of deeper healing, what's necessary is to let go of the identification we have with our thinking, with our thoughts. We have to find some way to step outside of our opinions and our expectations and biases and judgments. It doesn't mean that we have to stop having them. You don't have to be at war with all that. But you have to be able to hold them in such a way that you're not run by them or controlled by them. You don't identify with them so strongly. So instead of holding them with a tight fist, you hold them kind of lightly, kind of light holding. Or as I like to point out, many people confuse their thoughts, the nature of their thoughts. The way that many people relate to their thoughts is as if they're confusing the software for the hardware. The thoughts and our ideas and opinions, they're all the software of our life. But we take it to be such a firm reality as if it's the hardware, that that's why we get into trouble. We identify with it. One of the things that Vipassana teachers like to say is you don't have to believe your thoughts. And for some people that's a major revelation, that there's a choice, that your thoughts aren't necessarily believable. You don't have to. You can choose whether you believe them or not. So how to work with thoughts, how to go deep into thoughts. So there are, I think of four ways of working with thoughts. And there are kind of four different types of thoughts that can occur. Four ways of working with thoughts in the context of mindfulness practice. If the thoughts are in the background of your attention, and it's easy to stay with the breath or stay with something else that's in the foreground, you can just leave the thoughts in the background. You don't have to worry about them. One teacher I studied with said that it's as if you're walking with a friend through the woods in Maine in the fall, and it's a nice day, and the beautiful kind of red and yellow leaves are kind of falling lightly, and you're talking to your friend walking down the sidewalk, but mostly you're aware of talking with a friend, but you're kind of aware in the periphery of your attention these leaves that are falling. So same thing, thoughts are in the background, just let them be there. If you can stay clearly focused steadily on your breath or on whatever else is happening predominantly. But what happens often enough is the thoughts push themselves into the foreground. And so it's difficult to stay with the breath or difficult to stay with what's happening in the present because the thinking has entered the foreground of your attention. And that happens quite regularly when people meditate. And often when that happens, it happens that the strength of the thoughts are relatively mild. And by strength, the strength of a thought is measured primarily by how much we identify with it, how much we're involved with a thought. So when they're quite mild, it's enough just to bring awareness to the fact that you're thinking. And you can make a note, you can label it, thinking. And just bring your awareness to the fact that you're thinking. That awareness tends to soften or loosen up with whatever identification we have with our thoughts, and the thoughts will dissolve. Because thoughts only continue through time because we identify with them, because we participate in them. I like to distinguish somewhat, I guess, pedagogically maybe, but I like to distinguish between thinking and thoughting. It's a great word, thoughting. Thinking is a chain of thoughts. Thoughting is something the mind does. It's just a natural function of the mind to create thoughts and have thoughts. But when we have one thought that leads to another, that leads to another, we form a chain of associated thinking. Chain of associated thoughts, that's thinking. And thinking comes from participating with something, participating or identifying with it, getting caught by it. Thoughts just seem to happen. So in the mild thoughts, all you need to do is to bring your awareness to it and attempt to dissolve, and then you go back to your breathing or to your body or whatever it is that's predominant. Sometimes thoughts are more persistent and they don't simply dissolve when you bring your attention to them. Then you need to maintain your attention a little bit longer on your thoughts. Hold your awareness there. And you might keep noting it, thinking. And sometimes you might even be able to, if it's very, very simple and obvious, you can be a little bit more exact in how you name it. You might name it judging or planning or remembering or whatever kind of the word that characterizes it. Sometimes having a little bit more accurate label can soften the identification. But sustain your attention on this process of thinking. And the key word is process. We're not interested at all in the content of our thinking. The story, what you're thinking, has absolutely, almost, I would say, virtually no importance for the purpose of meditation practice. If you're thinking about who did what to who, or what happened at work today, or what's going to happen at work tomorrow, that has no value in the purpose of meditation practice. One of my teachers said, there's nothing you have to think about when you meditate. I wouldn't necessarily go quite that far, so extreme, say it's so extreme, but 99.99.9%, whatever, of the things we think about when we meditate, we don't have to think about. It's not necessary, and it's certainly not useful. There's plenty of other times to think about it, because we think all the time anyway, right? So don't worry about it. So it's not the story, not the content we focus on when we bring mindfulness to thinking, but it's just the event of thinking, the process of thinking. I'm thinking. And if it's a little bit more sustained attention sometimes will soften the identification, and eventually it'll pass, and or weaken enough so it's easy to go back to the breath and stay with the breath. However, sometimes thoughts are even more persistent. They can even be compulsive. And they just and there's various kinds of compulsive thinking. One kind is a kind that is very repetitive. That maybe they're not that strong, the thoughts, but they keep reoccurring. So you notice you keep drifting away from your breath or drifting away from the present, and you notice that every time you notice it thinking, and you notice that every time you drift away, it's planning or it's remembering. After a while, you notice that there's a pattern in the kind of distracted thoughts you have. If you notice the pattern of distracted thoughts reoccurring, that's a signal, a cue for us that there is some kind of underlying emotion, almost always, that's the factory for that kind of repetitive thinking. And so the thing to do is to be aware of that thinking, label it, and then be mindful, sensing and feeling, exploring, what, if any, subtle emotion is present while you're involved in planning or remembering or whatever it is, fantasy. And this is not analysis. You're not thinking about what it might be and why it should be, but you're quieting yourself and listening or sensing with the inner sense to what emotion is actually present in the cracks and crevices of that thinking pattern. So for example, and it's a little bit dangerous for me to give an example because then you set up the expectation of what to look for. But I'll give you this example. The majority of the time that people spend, when people are spending a lot of time planning in their meditation, planning about the future, thinking about something in the future, if they pay attention, they'll find that underneath all the planning is a subtle or not so subtle level of apprehension or fear. And the reason why there's all this planning is because this factory of fears keeps putting out those kind of thoughts. And if you keep bringing your awareness to planning and note planning or thinking, it might be that they dissolve right away and you go back to your breath and you stay with the breath for 2 or 3 cycles and then off you go planning again. And you note, you're a good meditator, so you note thinking and it goes away, you go back to your breath and planning again. Mm-hmm. Because the factory is not acknowledged. And so if something is not acknowledged, we'll keep producing these kinds of planning thoughts. But if you can bring your awareness to feel the apprehension or the fear and sense it and explore it in the body in the way we talked about last week, then the factory won't automatically keep triggering more thoughts along those lines. And the factory will, we have a chance to kind of come to terms with the factory, to understand it, find your peace with it, and maybe even the factory, the fear, will dissipate. And then you're dissipated, you've dissolved or stopped identifying with some of the roots of that kind of planning thinking. Does that make sense? It's a very important point. So again, it's not analysis about what the situation is, but it's looking more carefully, exploring more carefully, what's going on here? One of the mantras you can use as a mindfulness meditator is, what's happening? What's happening? What's going on here? Okay, and there's another kind of compulsive kinds of thinking, which is much stronger. It just is very, very powerful, and maybe it keeps coming back, but it comes back very strongly, or just simply doesn't go away at all. Just kind of, you know that you're thinking about this theme. You know you're thinking about this memory from work today, and you've noted it many times, and you know it, and you've been aware of it. And it just has a life of its own. It's just churning out, you know, reviewing the day and whatever it might be. When thoughts are very compulsive like that, again, it can be very useful to be aware of the emotion under it. There are no compulsive thoughts without some kind of underlying emotion. And the emotion could be pleasant or unpleasant. It could be great joy. It could be great curiosity. It could be great states of calm. It can be what's under it. Or it could be something more difficult to work with, like anger or fear or grief. But to see if you can recognize that. And if you recognize the emotion, then you drop down into the body and feel the emotion in the body and all the things we talked about last week. But in addition, what you can do with very compulsive thinking is, as part of being mindful of the event, the process of thinking, is to be aware of the physicality of that thinking process. When thoughts are very, very compulsive, there's almost always a physical component to that kind of thinking. And if you pay attention to see, well, how does it feel to have this compulsive thinking? You might find energetically a physical manifestation. So you might feel kind of a tightness in the skull or in the brain, or a tight band around the forehead, or something energetically in the face, or energy kind of cursing kind of confusingly kind of through the brain, or you might find a tenseness in the face or the neck or the chest, or you might find some corollary in the body that is the expression of the energetics of that kind of compulsive thinking. You feel agitated, whatever. And then you found something tangible. And it's always useful to find something tangible in this meditation. And then you connect your mindfulness to the tangible feeling and sense and explore it, you name it, tightness, energy, vibration, whatever. And then you're connecting to the event and not the story. And then you're really present for it, and you stay present for it, and you can get very concentrated, and that can help soften the identification around that very compulsive thinking. So are you still with me? Does this make sense to you? Or it's kind of talk, it's a lot of kind of complicated instruction. Don't worry if you don't remember all this. All you have to remember is the mantra. What's happening here? You keep it really simple, right? Or what's the predominant thing happening here? And then you rest your awareness there. Okay? And if you don't remember all this, then at some point you'll learn it when you need to learn it. Or a little after. So this is an example of the last thing you can do when there's a lot of thoughts. Or maybe it's the first thing you do, I don't know. But the first and the last thing you can do when thoughts are thoughts, when they're strong or weak or whatever. Mullah Nasruddin decided to start a flower garden. He prepared the soil and planted the seeds of many beautiful flowers. But when they came up, his garden was filled not just with his chosen flowers, but also overrun by dandelions. He sought out advice from gardeners all over and tried every method known to get rid of them, but to no avail. Finally, he walked all the way to the capital to speak to the royal gardener at the Sheikh's palace. The wise old man had counseled many gardeners before and suggested a variety of remedies to expel dandelions. But Mullah had tried them all. They sat together in silence for some time, and finally the gardener looked at Nasruddin and said, "Well, then I suggest you learn to love them." So don't make your thoughts a problem. They're your friends. Many meditators think their thoughts are a problem. Please don't think that. After I did my 3-month retreat at back east at a center we have back there, this man came to interview me. And he had been a long-time meditator who had a lot of difficulty with meditation. I think because he thought a lot in meditation. He was kind of planned a lot. He was a very analytical kind of person, always thinking about every possible thing. And he couldn't make much progress because he was thinking about everything all the time. And he came and asked me, you know, kind of imploringly, in this interview, what do you do about your thinking? About your thoughts? And I told him, I have a friendly relationship with my thoughts. And the poor guy almost fainted because he'd been struggling against them so much. And it's possible the struggles was part of the struggle against them was part of the reason why he was so agitated. sometimes struggling is counterproductive. When you first sit down after a busy day, like you talked about, what was it? Mark. You know, the mind is often kind of scattered and full of thoughts, kind of. And you can try being mindful of them in the way that I talked about, feel the energetics of it all. Sometimes the best thing to do is just, you know, when you just first sit down, the first 10, 20 minutes of the sitting, or you just simply try to stay with the breath the best you can. Keep coming back to the breath and back to the breath. And the mind will just kind of relax and don't worry about it too much. And with time, you know, just sitting there quietly, the mind will settle down. And then eventually, when the mind is settled enough, then you can bring awareness to your thoughts and be mindful of them in a clear enough way that you don't get caught by the story, and you can just allow them to be there the way they are, and then as part of the meditation. And then a warning. Maybe the way I talk this evening, and the way that many of us teachers explain the instructions around thoughts, it's as if it's so easy to hear them as if thoughts are a problem, and we give you the instructions as a way of helping you get rid of the thoughts. People often ask, you know, how do I work with thoughts? And what they mean is, how do I get rid of them? How do I stop them? And that's not really the point of meditation, to get rid of anything or to deny anything. The point is to see clearly what's happening. If you see clearly what's happening, you won't identify with things. If you don't identify with them, you don't perpetuate them, like our thoughts, and they'll dissipate. But the point is not to dissipate the thoughts. The point is to see clearly. Do you see the difference? So if thoughts dissipate, take that as a grateful byproduct. Don't take it as being what has to happen. Because then, otherwise, if you take it to be what has to happen, then you're asking for trouble. You're asking for to be disappointed and struggle and all. The point is, you know, try to establish your practice with some kind of ease with what's happening, and then just simply see clearly. Any questions about that? Yes?
Yeah, it seems to me that when I'm trying to meditate, a lot of times I'm so far gone in my thinking before I even notice that I'm thinking.
Uh-huh.
I may have been thinking for 5 minutes
Well, a couple of things to say. One is, it's very interesting to pay attention to what precedes disappearing into fantasy or to distractions. So you bring your, you stay attentive to your breath, stay present in the present, and try to investigate and clearly discern what's happened just before your mind drifts off. That's one thing you can do. And that does two things. That investigation, that will kind of keep you present. So it's kind of a trick. But that's not the reason I told you. Is because sometimes it's very interesting what happens just before you disappear into fantasy. And to become aware of that is fascinating. You learn something about yourself. I'd like to point out, maybe this is a good time to say it, you can't do mindfulness practice wrong. Isn't it great to do something you can't do wrong? And what I mean is, either you're doing it or you're not doing it. When you're doing it, there's no problem because you're doing it, right? If you're doing it, if you're mindful, if you're aware of what's happening, you're not doing it, you know, you're doing it right. It's a pretty simple thing to be aware. If you're not doing it, you're not even aware you're not doing it. So there's no problem. Right? I mean, you're not even there enough to know that you're not doing it. At some point, you notice you haven't been doing it. But then you're aware. So you're doing it again. So you're doing it right. So you can smile, you can celebrate. So every time you're kind of aware of your present again, or you're aware you drifted off, you should be celebrating. Wow, I'm back, I'm present. And I mean, you have the option, of course. If you can notice you've been drifting away, and notice it, and then you can beat yourself up. You have that option. But it's not a very particularly attractive option. So to come back after 5 minutes is great. And especially when people begin meditating, it's quite common for people to drift off for long periods of time. And don't measure the success of your meditation by how much you can be, how often you can be present. The point is, whenever you remember to come back. And it's kind of like strengthening the muscle. And with time, the muscle will get stronger and stronger, and you'll stay more and more present. But it's like, you know, we're so hard on ourselves and our poor minds. But if you think of your mind as you know, like a baby learning to walk, or a child learning to play a piano. I mean, you don't yell at your child because it fell. It stood up, took a step and fell the first time ever. You lousy, you know, you failed at walking. You know, you're very patient with a child, and it takes, I don't know how long it takes a child to learn to walk, but it takes trying over and over and over again, and slowly they learn. Or you play, what do they call scales up, you know, for years people play scales to learn to play a piano, and then they become really good. People expect to be able to be, you know, champion meditators overnight. The mind, you know, it's like a muscle that gets trained and practiced, and so be patient. In any case, as the story of Mula Nasruddin and Dandelions, the fundamental practice is simply to accept who you are. And if you're a person who wanders away for 5 minutes at a time, the practice is to accept yourself as that. That's more the practice than just accept who you are, and that's the foundation for really waking up to your full life. Don't make anything a problem. Just when you notice that you can bring more presence and mindfulness, do it. And then it will get stronger and stronger with time.
I want to ask an embarrassing question. And since you brought up dandelions, this is a little off the subject, but when the teacher last week was talking about protecting life, I'm having a major problem with slugs and snails. And I stopped poisoning them about 3 years ago, but I go out and put them in a bag and throw them away, and now I'm just like guilt-ridden. I've been passing these slugs and snails, and I can't. No, I can't.
Need
that, but I know they're gonna.
Yeah, well, that's another guilt thing.
They get hurt when you throw them. So serious, but they destroy, you know, my art.
Uh-huh.
Really.
So. Well, it's not embarrassing. It shouldn't be an embarrassing question. It's a great question. And I think many people ask those kinds of questions, and it's optional to some degree, the whole arena of Buddhist ethics. But mindfulness practice is done on top of a foundation of ethics. And we often teach these introductory classes without the ethics first, and because no one would stay if we did 5 weeks on ethics first. But in Southeast Asia, most of the monks wouldn't dream of talking about mindfulness without first talking about ethics. So we get, you know, I kind of sneak it in afterwards. But you can't really do this practice seriously without the foundation on ethics. You can't sit down and expect to get concentrated and calm in your meditation if you spent the whole day lying. It's not possible. And ethics, living ethical life, is a very important part of both mindfulness practice, but also Buddhist practice. So asking those kind of questions means that you're beginning to engage the rest of your life in a deeper way around I don't know what stimulates you, but it could be from either from being more mindful and more sensitive, or from reflecting on ethical values. It's a difficult question for someone to answer. A traditional Theravada Buddhist response is you shouldn't kill anything, no life at all. And if the slugs eat your garden, that's the way it is. And if you could think of some compassionate way to take all the put the slugs in a bag and take them down to the municipal park, or well, not somebody else's garden, but maybe some open space preserve where that's maybe a great solution, or that's what Buddhists tend to do with mice. They have these have a heart traps, and so they get the mice and have a heart that keeps them alive, and then they release them someplace far away.
They designed all kinds of contraptions to catch spiders and other household pests that normally people mush with a Kleenex, suck it into a jar and put them in the garden.
Was it Kamala last week who told a story about the shrimp?
Yeah, it really got. I stuck on a slug before talking. I felt bad.
The teachings of Buddhism is that if you kill something without any intention, it's accidental. That's just the way things are. And you try your best not to, but if it happens, that's the way things are. And there's no karma from that, and you don't necessarily have to feel any guilt. Guilt is considered to be an unproductive emotion in Buddhism. Because guilt is a kind of a self-hate, and it's not, there's no reason. Dwelling in the past and kind of holding on to some kind of resentment or self-hate or something. So it's fine to kind of recognize that you've done something that you don't feel good about, and then you can look forward to how can I do better in the future. But think about, pests in the garden, what to do. Well, we don't have to get into details. There are things people do to try to avoid the snails, and there's things that can be done, and you can go to Common Grounds maybe and ask them, and they have tried. So I'll tell you the classic answer in Buddhism is you can't. You shouldn't kill anything. And that's the way it goes. However, if you're pragmatic and you think about causes and conditions a little bit, and you realize, well, if I don't have a garden, I'm going to get my produce from Safeway. And Safeway, maybe you buy commercial produce, and there is a lot of death that goes into making commercial produce, and you're not the one killing, but there's maybe a million times, thousand times more insects getting sprayed to death in the fields of Salinas than there are in a few slugs in your garden. Maybe it's not so black and white, and you try to think deeply about the situation and the context, and what's given that there's maybe no way of really avoiding some kind of killing. How do you do it to avoid the unnecessary killing, and then do what has to be happened in a respectful way, like the American Indians would always respect deeply what they had to kill. When I was a gardener at the monastery, every gardener has to deal with the gophers, what to do about gophers. And at the monastery there was no guidelines. They left each gardener, it was like a koan, each gardener had to deal with it themselves. So it was my turn to deal with the gophers. And some gardeners decided not to kill the gophers, and I respect deeply that decision. My decision, which I don't particularly feel proud about, but this was my decision, was that the gophers, I wanted to really respect the life of the gophers. But I felt also that the garden had a life too. And there was a kind of a life force there of intention, of value, of something there. A lot of people benefited, not just simply from the food in the garden, but from the from the healing qualities of being in the garden and seeing it. And it was a manifestation of the deep intention of effort of a lot of different people. And that was a kind of a life also. So it was the balance then between the life of that garden, in a sense, and the life of the gophers. And in the way it weighed in my mind, I decided to put traps for the gophers. I tried all kinds of other things, but to no avail. So I think in my mind, again, this is a personal opinion, a person who's taking Buddhist ethics and mindfulness and using those to understand their how to live their life, doesn't take them, you know, as black and white, but takes them very, very seriously, and then thinks and reflects and is deeply mindful of what's going on here, and comes to the best decision they can. And part of that, this is where mindfulness becomes very important, is reflecting deeply about what the intention is behind this act. So why do you want to have a garden? Is it because you want to have the best roses on the block and you want to be able to bring your best roses to the county fair and so you can be really kind of really proud of yourself and kind of get this big trophy and, you know? Is it worth it in that context? Because of your own egotistic pride about being the best gardener on the block? Is it, you know, is it slugs or your pride? Or is the motivation to feed your family in a way that doesn't participate in all this massive destruction that happens in the Central Valley? Or so then maybe there's less destruction by growing my own food and being self-sufficient to some degree. And maybe I'll try to only kill those gophers or those snails that really are getting close. And maybe I'll make a big, big clear cut, a big border around my garden so there's like 3 feet of bare ground that they're unlikely to cross. And if they cross, I'll pick them up and put them back over there, 3 feet away. And or I'll only kill the ones who manage to get across the bare ground. Or who knows? But there is no right or wrong answer in my mind. Though the Buddhist tradition, if you ask the very traditional Buddhist monk, they would say there is one. But mindfulness practice is a practice of clarifying for yourself, becoming your own authority. So it's a very good question, and I think that as people's mindfulness practice deepens, with that comes increased sensitivity to how we feel and how we relate to the world and to the feelings of the world and the feelings of the people around us and the animals. And it's natural as that sensitivity deepens to have those kind of questions. And it's not so uncommon for some people, for the people who have unwholesome livelihoods, is as they deepen their mindfulness practice to feel that they have to either give up their job or give up their mindfulness practice. Because some jobs are simply not possible to do them and be very mindful. It's like this lawyer who came to retreat and asked, very sincerely he asked, how can I continue lying and be a good mindfulness student? And he was asking, you know, how to lie mindfully. And he was told, you can't. You can't if that's what your job. He said, my job involves lying. He was very upfront about it. Certain jobs, like producing weapons. Usulananda, who's this wonderful Burmese monk in Delhi City, was asked at a conference on Buddhist ethics some years ago what the most difficult ethical issue that he had to face as a monk in America. And the most difficult issue for him was how to counsel his Buddhist parish members, because most of them were Burmese. And some of them, he said, work in the military-industrial complex. They have jobs at making tanks or bullets or guns, or they're kind of participating in this big military-industrial complex we have in this country. And they come to him and they ask him, you know, is this the right livelihood? What should I do? And he knows that it's very hard, he said, for Burmese immigrants to find work. and they have to support a family, and he's torn then. He knows that it's wrong livelihood. But he doesn't feel he can tell them that because he knows how difficult it is to find work. So that's where he found it, his biggest ethical dilemma of being a monk in America. So maybe it's getting late. I would have wanted to sit longer than we have now. But let's sit for a few minutes together. And